Hello and welcome to episode 17 of the Poolside Pass podcast. On today's episode, I'm joined by Ewan Dale, Director of Swimming at Millfield School in Somerset. I'm going to be speaking to Ewan about his coaching career, but also about the importance of communication for a coach. I just want to say a big thank you to all the listeners and our guests that tuned in to episode 16 of the Poolside Pass podcast. That was a live episode that was streamed on YouTube. You can find it on our YouTube channel or on your favourite podcast player. Before we get stuck into the episode today, just a quick line from our sponsors, Streamlined.
Become a qualified swimming teacher with Streamlined in as little as 6 days. Learn at your own pace and be guided by our expert tutors. You can do your training face-to-face, online in real-time, or a combination of the two. Assessment can be in your club using videos or attending one of our assessment venues. We offer tailored, high-quality support. Quote the Poolside Pass for an extra 10% discount.
Okay, so I think it's about time I introduced Ewan. Ewan Dale, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Jimmy. Great to be here.
So why don't we just start with a little bit about your kind of background in the sport, how you started out and how you got into coaching?
Of course, yeah. Kind of fell into coaching a little bit, but I was a swimmer. I followed my brother, who's 4 years older than me, to the pool in a rural town up in the Scottish borders called Duns. At about 7 years old, something like that, joined my first swimming club. Stayed there through until 12 and then moved down to Millfield to be a swimmer. Big rugby family. My brother went to a rugby school in Edinburgh and I really enjoyed my swimming, and there was no real opportunity anywhere to combine swimming and school, so ended up at Millfield, which was the opposite end of the country really to where I grew up, but that's really when my swimming progressed, if you like. Was in an environment which was surrounded by, you know, great coaches, great swimmers. It was really aspirational, and I just dug in and went all the way through to the end of school at 18. And at that point, I made the decision to go to Loughborough and swim, and swam for 4 years there, and did a bit of international stuff on the swimming scene as well. And then while I was at Loughborough, I actually graduated in accounting and finance. So after my 4 years at Loughborough, went back up to Edinburgh and joined an accounting firm.
Right.
And then started doing a little bit of coaching on the side and in around that. And that's when I fell in love with it. And about 2 years later, 2010, I started back as an assistant coach down at Millfield. And that's kind of how I got into the sport as a coach. Quite a lot of experience as a swimmer, but actually didn't study sport or exercise science or sports science at university. But just fell in love with being on deck and interacting with students and whatnot, which was very different to being in an accounting office. So
I can imagine.
just passion really got me back in, to be honest, Jim.
Yeah, I think one thing that's really kind of hit home with me since I've been doing this podcast is the amount of coaches that didn't originally plan on going into coaching. They planned on doing something else, but then just ended up falling in love with it. And I think I can definitely relate with the like catching the coaching bug, as I say. And once you've started, you can't really stop with it.
And it's just it's in your blood, you know. As a swimmer, you need to be really into the sport, I think, and that's what will separate you from being good or being great, I think. And if you've got that in you, then coaching is a natural avenue. And you know, I was dead against it. I was like, I'm not going to go into coaching. Not going to do it. 2 years away, I just couldn't help myself. You know, I was at work looking up swimming results at lunchtime, looking at all the races, whatnot. I was like, what am I doing? You know, and, you know, just took a plunge.
So when you were swimming, you swam out of Loughborough, and amongst other coaches, you worked with kind of Ian Armiger, spent a lot of time around Ian. We had Ian on as a guest earlier on in the podcast. What did you learn from Ian as a swimmer that you now transfer into your own coaching?
I mean, Ian was just something extraordinary. You know, I'd come from Millfield, where training was quite regimented. and I wouldn't say overly exciting. Turned up to Loughborough, saw Ian Armiger on deck for the first time, and you know, this energy, charisma, enthusiasm that came through is certainly something that I remind myself of regularly when I walk onto poolside.
Yeah.
Because I think when you walk onto poolside, you've got to understand that you are the role model, you are the people that are looking up to you, and you know, that positivity that he brought was unbelievable. But the other thing that really impressed me about Ian Armiger when I was there as a swimmer is how he orchestrated the program. And what I mean by that is there was obviously four or five coaches there that were quite well-developed coaches, and Ian Turner, Ben Titley, Ian Armiger, Steve Bailey. But the way he orchestrated and managed all of those little segments to lend itself to Loughborough growing into a powerhouse was just fascinating to see, really. And it was his personality that brought it all together.
Yeah.
So I try and bring that into my coaching as well.
Good.
Actually, more into my management of a program, I'd say, than my coaching, that orchestrated bit.
Yeah. So you were saying earlier you kind of were an accountant for a while, and you started coaching in Edinburgh. Was that at Warren de Bath's?
Yeah, so I actually started doing a little bit of one-to-one stuff on the side to begin with, and then I got in touch with Laurel Bailey at Warren de Bath's, and she gave me a really low-key job within the program. You know, it was probably only a couple of squads up from the Learn to Swim kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it was maybe four sessions a week, something like that. But it was unbelievable. You know, I was looking forward to that moment all week, you know, those sessions all week. And then she was actually away on international duty at one of the weeks. And she asked me to cover the top squad for 1 week while she was away, you know, kind of 3-4 months after I started with the junior squad. And that was probably the moment that I really realized that I absolutely was destined for it, you know, because I was sitting at work, planning the sessions, getting ready for it, getting excited, walking on deck, couldn't believe what I was seeing. And, you know, there's kids in the pool that are still swimming now, you know, people like Craig Benson and whatnot. And that was when I really caught it, you know, really caught the bug. And, you know, huge, huge thanks to Laurel for allowing me to do that at such a young age, you know, and as such young experience. But I really think that that's what got me in.
Wow. So Warren de Bath being very much like a standard kind of club program, age group program, and then moving over to Millfield, be part of more of a boarding school program. What were the big differences you saw there in kind of how the programs run?
Yeah, I mean, Warren de Bath is a huge club in Edinburgh, and it's a massive operation, you know, running out of so many different pools, you know, lots of coaches. And when I arrived at Millfield, it was literally the director of swimming at the time, it was Joel Fink, absolute legend, and then me and another coach, and that was it. And, you know, we were running the senior school program. And the main differences, Jamie, were quite simple. Resource, we had our own pool, 8-lane, 50-meter, not a huge number of swimmers, and the intensity within the training was a lot higher. And then obviously you've got the logistical stuff of a boarding school. You know, you're working at a club like Warrender, and you know it's all these different coaches have other jobs, whereas you go into Millfield and you're bang in the middle of a school. You know, and you're all encompassed by that, and you know the group tutors, the academic teachers, the pastoral staff, the headmaster, the director of sport, and you're in and amongst it all day, every day, and that's really the main difference.
So, I imagine working within a boarding school, you play a very big role in developing swimmers as people, not just swimmers, and as coaches in general, it's part of the job. But I imagine it's that kind of role is more pronounced in a boarding school environment. How do you kind of go about making sure that you do that to the best that you can?
Yeah, you're 100% right. You know, if you think about a boarding school student, I think what I will say at the start of answering this question is Millfield is both a day and boarding school. Right. So quite a large proportion of our swimming base actually live in a local area. Probably about 25 to 30% live in the local area. And, you know, the remainder are our boarding students that come in just for the school term. But yeah, you're 100% right. You know, we probably see kids more than any other member of staff within the school, including the house parent, you know, on a daily basis. So for me, understanding, well, you're bang on, you know, coaching is about developing people. Performance is a side product. You know, you do a good job of developing a person, and the performance takes care of itself. And, you know, at the end of the day, almost everybody is going to stop swimming at some point, and it's the lessons that they've developed over time that's going to carry forward. But how do I go about that? Quite simply, I outline experiences, I outline stories, I tell stories of people that I went to school with, of people that I've coached, and I don't just tell the ones that win the world championships. I tell the ones that went on to have an experience within swimming and went on to a different workplace. And you talk about the characteristics, you know, you talk about the importance of work ethic, the importance of kindness, the importance of authenticity and all those types of things that are going to carry forward. And, you know, I tend never really to mention the word performance, because once you start doing that, you're taken away from the fundamental aim of development of a child.
Yeah.
And development of a person. And you know, I think performance is just a byproduct of a good job at that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I liked what you said at the start there, where make them a better person, the performance looks after itself. I think that's a really good line for people to remember.
It's aligning people as well, you know. Every coach is slightly different, and you know, some I've had coaches in the program that are amazing at that, you know, developing people and doing all those things and making sure you put them at the right spot in the development journey, you know. And it might be that they're slightly more experienced or they've had slightly better swimmers in the past, but you know, if our aim is the development of an individual, discovering brilliance in every individual, which is our aim, you've got to put the right people at the right spots.
Yeah. So moving on now around kind of the more practical aspect of coaching, how do you manage to plan your season around, because obviously you've got to contend with school holidays, summer's returning home for periods of time. How do you kind of plan your season to work within that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Great question. And that's been a challenge for some coaches that have come in from a club program into the school environment, is understanding that you don't have contact with everyone all the time. But my explanation of this is quite simple. You look at it and you've got to understand that a boarding school there's an intensity to it. You know, you're always in an environment with people, whether it be swimming, classroom or the boarding house. And that is energy consumption.
Yeah.
You know, when you go back home as a swimmer in a club program within a city or whatnot, you go home of an evening and it's a little bit more relaxed. Whereas you go into a boarding house and, you know, there's still a vibrant nature around that. So it costs energy. So what actually happens is half terms come as a nice little regeneration process. You know, they go home for a week, they maintain their swimming to a degree, and they get a lot more rest and recovery. And that re-energizes them for the next phase. So in answer to your question, we just kind of program it into our periodization, you know, those regen spots. You know, we put a competition on the last weekend of our school half term in October, and then they have a little bit of a regen period over the half October half term, and then we go back to it. The tricky one is generally Easter and summer.
Yeah.
With British Championships generally happening on the last week of the Easter holidays, and nationals or British summer nationals happening midway through the summer break. So yeah, we tend to put some training camps on at that time so we can keep that consistency going into those key competitions.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good idea to make sure that you can, especially around those key competitions, make sure you maintain some kind of input, because the last thing I guess you want is them kind of returning just to finish off their taper or to finish off their preparation into a key meet. where you've...
Yeah, I mean, it's twofold, Jimmy. You know, it's twofold. You're right. You know, if you want to maintain control of that, of course you want that consistency. But at the same time, what are we ultimately planning for? All right, we're ultimately planning for independence. We're ultimately planning to put a kid on a team that's going to be coached by someone else. You know, so they've got to have the awareness and the understanding of what they need at that point. Obviously, the younger the kid is, the more input and, you know, the more information you're going to have to give them. But as they grow through the program, you know, technically they should be able to go home and swim in a public lane and do what they need to do. But we do communicate quite a lot with home club coaches and just make sure that there is a consistency of messaging generally around the technical aspects rather than worrying too much around the physiological stuff. Because generally in the last 10 days before a competition, every club in the country is pretty much doing something similar.
Yeah. Yeah. So in your time coaching, you've worked with many swimmers that have represented Great Britain either as a junior or a senior. Within your kind of coaching group, what are your cultural non-negotiables when you're working with people that are high performing?
Yeah, you know, high performing and, you know, a regional finalist, the non-negotiables are pretty simple. You know, communicate. Yeah. You know, we need to know how you're feeling, what's going on, if you're going to be attending all the sessions that you've signed up to or not. You know, and that is the biggest non-negotiable. We've obviously got a code of conduct in terms of behavior and how people operate. But every kid that I've coached to a high level, if you like, they're all different. And they all need to be communicated with differently. And they all need to be developed differently. You need to make coaching interventions at different stages. You know, and that's the key. You know, you look at someone, I remember working with James Guy, you know, he had an intensity about him forever. From the day that I met him, he had an intensity about him and a willingness to achieve. Whereas you look at someone like a Cameron or someone like that, it took a little bit longer, you know, and it was just making sure that you make an intervention when needed for that individual. And that's the key, you know. But the non-negotiables in terms of behavior, attendance, communication are there. But for me, utilizing or developing the brilliance within all the different ways of doing it is being able to be flexible and being able to educate them in a way that they can maximize their opportunities. But we have a value called be a disruptor.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't understand something, positively question it. Ask why.
Yeah.
You know, ask those types of questions. You know, because if you can do that, then you're creating self-awareness as you go through, and you're creating a greater understanding. You know, I think the days of kids just getting in there and doing exactly what the coach says from age 11 to age 18, you've got to question that. You know, kids have to be a little bit more on it in terms of asking questions. You know, why am I doing 3 5,000s? You know, what's the point in that? Or why am I doing 650s all out from the blocks? You know, if you can't answer that as a coach, you know, you're not doing your job.
I think when we had Dave Champion on the podcast, he said he's got a rule. And if any of his swimmers ask why they're doing something and he can't explain why, then they don't have to do it. And
that's invaluable information there, you know, because it develops the kids. And, you know, of course, the cheeky ones are going to over-challenge on that. And that's fine. And at some time, you might need to go, actually, you're just challenging for the sake of challenging here, because you know there's an hour 45 time limit on this session and you're just trying to get me to communicate to you for 10 minutes so you're not swimming. And, you know, it's being wise to that as a coach. You know, a high-performing kid of mine, Brody Williams, that's just moved to the National Centre in Bath, he would try and keep me talking for hours, you know, when I was doing the set explanation at the start. But, you know, it's, yeah, No, it's a great point, Matt. And I did hear that on the podcast, to be fair.
You always get those swimmers that you finish explaining the set for the second time and they say, so we're going to do four of this and then four of that. And then...
Yeah. So, it shows a bit of character, to be fair, yeah. But it does snap out sometimes.
So in just moving back again to your career as a swimmer, you swam for Great Britain in the 400 medley at the 2008 Beijing Games. How does having swum kind of at the top level help you when you're coaching? What do you take from those experiences when you was performing at the top level into your delivery as a coach?
I'd go as far as to say it doesn't help you.
Okay.
At a certain level. You know, I think when you go... When I first started up in coaching full-time, and certainly when I was at Warrender, I wouldn't say me being an international swimmer helped in any way, shape or form, other than knowledge of the sport and a little bit of credibility from the swimmers. But what I was doing at that point is because I had such a defined knowledge in a certain area, I was trying to use that on a daily basis, which was the wrong thing to do, because you've got to come down to their level and you've got to explain it at a certain point, at a certain certain way of delivery. So as I went through, I'd probably say I had to relearn a lot of things.
Yeah.
But where being an international swimmer does help, I think, is when you get into the pressurized arena. So when I got to British Summer Championships for the first time, or when I went to World Juniors for the first time, or European Juniors, or when I went on the staff at the World Championships, or whatever it might be, you know how to operate in that environment. So yeah. You don't get overly stressed. You don't get overly anxious. It's familiar. And I think that helps the kids a little bit, or the swimmers a little bit. But in terms of the day-to-day operations, you've got a technical knowledge of the sport, and an understanding of it. Certainly I did. I was big on that as a swimmer. And, you've got an understanding of what it takes. But in order to connect really with a swimmer, you've got to get to their level and you've got to understand them as individuals, not just trying to relive your journey through someone else.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough when I started in at coaching in 2010, legendary Joel Fink gave me a group of young boys which had James Guy in it, who was a very similar physiology to me, and I could relate to that quite easily, and it created quite a good connectivity. But for some of the other kids, I had to work a little bit harder on getting that connectivity and developing that development plan, if you like.
So when we spoke to Mel Marshall about kind of the challenges she faces as an athlete coming into coaching, she said that actually it threw up quite a few barriers instead of being an aid to her. Did you find, again, there was some barriers because you competed at the top level, people were necessarily, I don't know how to phrase this, but like almost not looking down on you, but thinking that you're not a coach, you're an athlete?
I don't think I really got that side of things because I went in at a certain level.
Yeah.
You know, I'd had a little bit of exposure at, you know, the real junior end within the club program at Warrender. But then, you know, I was kind of third, fourth in line at Millfield in terms of coaching hierarchy. So I didn't really feel any obstacles. I mean, as I said, it gave me a little bit of credibility with the swimmers. But also on poolside, I felt like I could ask more questions of the top end coaches because they knew me as a swimmer and there was a contact in there already. So it allowed me to unpick a little bit more information from them. And, you know, I remember I used to drive home from Millfield up to Scotland for a break. And I used to stop off at all the swimming clubs on the way, you know, I'd stop in at Loughborough, I'd stop in at all the swimming clubs just to reconnect with what was going on. So, from that side of things, I actually found that it gave me a little bit of an in. But no, I didn't really feel any obstacles, to be honest. And, you know, I was nowhere near the level of swimmer that Mel Marshall was, you know. So I don't think I really had that attachment to me.
Okay. So flipping out now from being a swimmer into coaching and now just talking generally again about where you're at in coaching, how do you communicate with the swimmers? How does, as a swimmer matures through your program, how does styles of communication need to change? You've already mentioned that different swimmers need different types of communication. How do you kind of cater for all of this when you've got so many kids in your program that you need to kind of communicate with?
Yeah, we did an interesting exercise at Millfield under our previous director of sport, a chap called David Faulkner, which was based around psychometric testing and understanding the DISC model. And I know within the governing body at the moment, they do a little bit similar stuff on insights. And that basically looks at individuals within four different types of personality and outlining which ones are more dominant within each individual's. Mm-hmm. And I really took that on board and tried to really understand that side of things, because what it does is it allows you to quite quickly identify what kids need within their personality type. So I'll give you an example. If you've got someone that's a big personality, you know, big high yellow, if you like, in the psychometric testing, their biggest fear is rejection and their biggest motivation is recognition. So you're talking to them about a pre-race talk or, you know, getting them up for a set, and you go, look, if you achieve this, just think about the reward you're going to get. It might be a good news through the school system, which is going to go to the house parent and whatnot, and that's a real motive for them.
Yeah.
Or, you know, if they're feeling anxious and nervous, they might be thinking, oh, if I don't perform here today, you're going to reject me as a coach. You know, they might be thinking that, you know, if it's a big moment, and you can just reassure them before the race by going, hey, look, whatever happens today, you know, we're all good. You know, this is going to be exciting. We're on a journey together. And that might be what they need at that point. Whereas if you've got someone that's maybe high blue, high on detail, all they want to know before the race is they're really motivated and driven by clarity and you know, statistics, if you like, or rules. And, you know, you just talk to them about the specific race strategy. Okay, you're going out at 45 stroke rate for the first 50 off the turn. You bring in the legs and you try and hold that momentum all the way through, whatever it might be. And, you know, they really hate chaos. So you wouldn't throw any chaos into them. You know, you'd know that they need to go down exactly 20 minutes before the race, and that's fine. And you make sure that all of that's programmed and systematic. So that really helped me going through that process, understanding myself, where my personality sat, and what I might need to do or say to individuals as you go through. So that's kind of how I think about it. You know, when I'm looking at a kid, I'm thinking, right, what do they need from me today? What is their personality trait, if you like? You know, what type of communication would that lend itself to? And, you know, talking to them as a group about it, you know, and getting them to understand where they might sit on that.
Yeah. Just interesting there to talk about that kind of communication model. Just for those listeners that might not be aware of it, what's it called and where can they find some information on that?
It's called DISC. And if you just type DISC into Google, and you'll find it all up there. And basically it's four colors. It's red, yellow, green, and blue. And every person's got a bit of everything, but some are more dominant than the other. So for example, me, I have a high yellow and a high blue. A high yellow and a high red, sorry, which means, you know, yellow is I and it stands for influencer, and D is dominant and it stands for kind of maybe more of your autocratic leader, if you like.
Cool. So coaches, if you're interested in finding more about that kind of communication model, make sure you check it out on Google. I certainly will be.
There's loads of different ones that lots of people use, but as I say, you know, I tend not to specifically test kids on it or get them to fill out the questionnaires. It's just I have an understanding of which each mode looks like, and yeah. You know, you can start to think about where kids sit on that.
Cool. So just to kind of finish off, I just wanted to briefly talk about efficiency. It's something I've spoken with a number of guests about. What are the main ways that you might promote efficiency within your swimmers? So, for example, talk us through a nice efficiency progression that you might run with some swimmers.
Yeah. Efficiency is everything to me. You know, and I'll go back to where this started, because I got obsessed with this as a swimmer. Obsessed, because I was 5'10", you know, and I was always the small kid, you know, all the way through school, the whole time I was the small kid. And I had to swim big. So I learned how to be the most efficient as I possibly could be, because that was the only way I was going to be competitive, you know, and that's how I started on that. So when I was a swimmer, you know, I was always counting my strokes. You know, I had three things that I thought about, right? Effort, distance per stroke or stroke count, and heart rate. So I was constantly trying to get my stroke count as low as possible. And I just remember always thinking about that all the time. You know, if I was doing a breaststroke pace set, each 50, I could only take 14 strokes. And, you know, if it meant that my heart rate or effort had to go down to achieve that, I always would, because I put the importance on swimming big, because it was the biggest thing that I saw when I looked at swimmers on the screen. You know, because you've got to think that I was growing up looking at Popov, looking at Thorpe, looking at all these swimmers that just looked like monsters in the water. You know, they just ate up water. And, you know, it's the same deal now. You look at people like Dressel and all them, they just look gigantic in the water. But anyway, back to the question. Efficiency, how do I look at it? I look at the basis. Alignment, kick, building the kick up into the stroke, and then bringing in the arms. So one of the things that we did all the time growing up, you know, Millfield kind of got a reputation as a certain way of swimming freestyle. And, you know, that was built around our kick integration set. So we do lots of work in alignment kick, snorkel on, high intensity, high effort. And then we bring in the arms and try and keep that speed with the least amount of strokes. So if you're doing, like, think about it. If you're doing a 50 fast kick, right, you got a good kicker, they're going like short course, 35 seconds for a 50 kick, right?
Yeah.
In your head, you're going, hang about, they're only like a 2-minute swimmer or a 150 swimmer for a turn freestyle. That's only 27 seconds per 50. So you're like, hang about, you bring in your arms and you're only going 8 seconds quicker. and you know, just think about that as a principle. So what we used to do at the end of every kick set or each round of every kick set is we used to bring in the arms, put the lopadope stroke on it, and then see how little strokes we could do to try and hit pace with the huge leg kick in the background. Now, one thing I would say about that is I got pretty hooked on that for a wee while, you know, that lopadope stroke, the 1-2, and it works for a very specific type of individual. Yeah. If you've got a strong outboard motor, you know, a strong kick, that's fantastic, and it can really, really work. And if you can turn the legs on and off, it creates back end speed. But the ability to turn the legs on and off is the big thing, you know, because you can set a swimmer out with a strong kick, a nice lopadope stroke, but if their legs go, everything goes. Yeah. So being able to turn the legs on and off is a mechanical skill. But also you've got swimmers that need a consistent rhythm to their stroke rate. So actually, by doing those kick integration strokes, you're taking away their natural efficiency, which is kind of that metronome, like David Davis, if you like. Boom, 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 boom. And if you try to do those lopadope kick efficiency sets for someone like that, you're actually taking away their efficiency, if that makes sense. Their innate efficiency, which is boom, 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 breathing every three or breathing every two, boom, boom, boom. So you've got to understand what you're working with when you're talking about efficiency. There's no one model, you know, and you know, especially when you're thinking about females, if you're looking at that Lopidot stroke, because their strength to weight ratio is slightly different to the males in general, you know, and they need an even greater outboard motor if they're going to make that stroke effective. Yeah. Or, you know, a really good strength to weight ratio. So when you're thinking about efficiency, you got to think about what sits the most naturally with that swimmer. I don't know if that was a little bit confusing there, but I think about it in quite a broad range.
Yeah. No, I think that's good. I think I like the way you build the stroke around the alignment and the leg kick. I think that's something personally I like to do as well. But I like the idea of, you know, that there's no single a single way to swim a certain stroke. There's different ways work for different people.
Exactly. You look at breaststroke. You know, that's such a wide variation of efficiency. You know, you look at someone like the old school Kitajima with what PT's doing now. You know, it's night and day. You know, so it's just understanding the strengths and then correlating that to their effective efficiency.
Or even with kind of Anton Chupkov, he swims two different styles and multiple different styles in the same race.
I saw that the first time in 2013. I was lucky enough to be at the World Championships, and it was a women's turn of breaststroke. Sorry, I'm getting digressing a little bit here, but women's turn of breaststroke, and the Danish girl in the semi-final went Pedersen, I think it was, went 2:19, and she did it standard. You know, like really efficient from the start, holding tempo, holding power. Obviously, a little increase in stroke count as she went through, but it was just a lesson in efficiency. And then in semi-final two, I think it was Efimova that literally went through three different strokes in the race. And I was sitting next to someone next to me. I was like, that Efimova is going to beat Pedersen tomorrow. I'm sure of it, because that Pedersen ain't got a change of gear. And, you know, Pedersen after semi-final was like giving it the Bifters world record or whatnot. I was like, I think she'll get beat tomorrow. And it was Efimova in the final where I really saw three different strokes.
That's
exactly what Chupkov does now. You know, that first 75, I've never seen anything so long in my life.
No,
it's unbelievable. And then there's a build phase, and then that last tempo on that last 50 is just madness.
It's crazy.
You're exactly right.
So just to finish off then, I'm just going to ask you for your top three points for developing good people as well as good swimmers.
For me, integrity, and honesty is huge, both from you being a coach of them, but them communicating with you. You've got to have that honesty and integrity about you. Number two, for me as a coach, is be open. You know, one thing I do every week is tell stories about my life, like what I've been up to on the weekend, and you know, so it encourages the kids to be open with you.
Yeah.
And then that's the way that you can really help guide them as individuals, you know, because you can really become a real role model that they can kind of relate to and be open with. Because you know what they say, it only takes one person. Only takes one person, whether it be a teacher, a coach, or even a peer, to really connect, and you can really change the direction of travel for someone. And that, I think, really links into them when they develop up and they can do that. And third and foremost for me, and I hope everyone that's been through the program can testify to this, is positivity. Mm-hmm. You know, I think if you can be positive about stuff, everything, you know, whilst being realistic, you know, then your outlook on life is going to be so much better.
Absolutely.
You know, and so for me, that would be number three. You know, so honesty and integrity, and openness, and then positivity. if we're talking about developing people 100%. But as I said at the start of the podcast, Jamie, and as I'll say again now, that should be the fundamental thing that you're thinking about as a coach. And performance will take care of itself after that. You know, because in my eyes, the physiology of what goes on in terms of the physical training aspect is pretty standard. You know, it's not rocket science.
No.
You try to make it rocket science, but if you don't connect with people, you don't develop them as people, you ain't gonna get to that top end.
Absolutely. For me, that was a great kind of top 3 points. We do it in every episode about different topics, and that was a really good way to describe how you try and develop good people as well as good swimmers. Ewan, thank you for your time today. It's been a pleasure to speak to you.
No worries. Thank you for inviting me along. And well done with all the great work you're doing on this, mate. I've listened to every single episode so far and loved it. So keep up the great work.
Thank you very much. Listeners, thank you for tuning in again. Just want to take the opportunity to point you towards our website. It's www.thepoolsidepass.com. We're on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at The Poolside Pass. Make sure you go check us out and share it with other coaches that you know if you enjoyed it. I certainly learned a lot from my conversation with Ewan today, and I hope you did too. Until next time, keep learning, and as Ewan says, stay positive.